He was laughing because I said something funny when we were recording this. Because I'm funny. Y'all don't know this, but I do, Jackson. He likes both kinds of music, country and western. There you go. And a little more Toby Keith here. My guest, very fortunate today. At the time we're talking about, he was a corporal. He'll ultimately get out as a sergeant, Jack Riley, from Gadsden, Alabama, and a member of India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, a proud member of the 2nd Platoon there, one of Lieutenant John Bobo's squad leaders, and graciously joined us to talk about the Battle of Gitlin's Corner. I don't know that I've ever heard of a battle that yielded more higher awards that took place in such a short period of time. A Medal of Honor and 4 Navy Crosses, yes?
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, we were later told that it was the highest decorated battle by one company in one day.
No, it's amazing. I thought about that. And yeah, exactly. I want to say Fox Company. Fox Company 2-7 in Korea. I mean, you read the story of what that company did and the awards that they received.
Yeah.
But that was over an extended, you know, that was over days and weeks that their fighting occurred. And,
right.
And so, but you, this is, this fight, how long does this fight ultimately last?
It was about 6 hours long in total. Of course, they mortared us all night long just to, you know, as their troops were heading back north towards the border.
All right, so Jack, you guys returned to Vietnam from Okinawa, and tell everybody you're joining a regiment that's executed a couple large operations, Prairie 1 and 2. We'll talk about that in a minute, but where do you guys go? What are you guys doing? You're in a different part of the fight during the Vietnam War. You've come from fighting the Viet Cong. Now you're going to fight the North Vietnamese. Talk to us about the differences. Talk about what you guys were doing when you got back in the country.
Well, it was a totally different war up north for us. We've been down there fighting PC and, you know, two or three man little units out. And but once we got up north, as we anticipated, we were going to be get some large force NVA outfits up there. We immediately changed the tactics to where we didn't go out on patrols, which we patrolled every single day if we weren't on operations. We patrolled usually with a squad and more so we patrolled with a reinforced squad, which meant we carried one M60 gun team with us also. You know, against the NVA, you needed overwhelming firepower, and so we went out much more in force, carried much more ammo with us. When we first got there, of course, John and I, Lieutenant Bobo, and I were the advanced team to the 3rd Marine, 2-3, Foxtrot 2-3, and we were taking over their KOR, which was all the way from Camp Carroll through KG a bridge to the rock pile, then south to Kalu, which is just outside of Quezon there. And we were patrolling this area from platoon patrol bases, with Camp Carroll being our CP. We did this for several weeks until we went out to company got hit, I can't remember exactly which one it was, company got hit on Prairie 2. Of course, you mentioned Prairie 1. Prairie 1 probably lasted the longest of the operations over there. Prairie 1 then ran into Prairie 2, and but you know how it is when you're a grunt. We never knew the names of operations until they were all over anyway. it was just another day in the bush. So, but we went out. on Prairie 2 then in the mid-March as a full-strength company. We Kemp Carroll had been shelled with a lot of 122-millimeter and 140-millimeter rockets, and in fact, we had several casualties up on the plateau, is what we call Kemp Carroll. So we were sent out as part of Operation Prairie 2 north of Dong Ha Mountain and to sweep Dong Ha Mountain, looking for all of these rocket launcher sites. And we were out there for, I don't know, maybe a week or so, and really didn't see too much. Our first platoon wiped out a squad of NVA, and it just so happened the NVA were protecting a cache of ammo and clothes and boots, and it's just a resupply dump that they were protecting that the first squad just happened to come up on, and but we didn't have any casualties on our side, but first platoon, first squad wiped all out. And but that was really the only contact we had on that operation. We've been out so long, we've been up in those mountains so long, everybody was, you know, just wore out. And to tell you how good the skipper was, he had everybody a cold beer waiting on us when we got back to Camp Carroll, which was kind of unheard of for us. And but any CO that would do that for his troops, you know, we were going to love this guy.
That's not a bad CO.
But we get back to Camp Carroll, and just within days, that ended Operation Prairie 2, and then Prairie 3 starts. And, of course, Gettler's called the battle there at Gettler's Corner was part of Operation Prairie 3.
What, in talking with the guys that you turned over, Jack, were you... were you cognizant of the fact that this fight, these fights were going to be different, and so I don't want to say a different skill set, but some of the battles up there around the DMZ from that part of the war were really really tough battles. I want to say Prairie One. I want to say 1,250 something Vietnamese NVA soldiers are killed, and about 250 Marines are killed in that fight. I mean, we're talking about significant, tough combat.
Well, we found out real quick. Anytime you make contact with the North Vietnamese, they only do it when the conditions are in their favor. You'll never draw them into a fight if they think they're not going to win it. So, our problem up there was actually trying to get them into a fixed battle. Right. And, it was something they were very reluctant to do because they knew they didn't have they didn't have air. They certainly didn't have all the artillery that we had. They had artillery. They had plenty of it, but, being right up there on the border with North Vietnam. But getting them, drawing them out into a fight was the tough thing. But we have to, now that we know history, we know what their plan was and what they were trying to accomplish. During Prairie 2, the majority of that time, they had decided that they were going to move everything in place into South Vietnam from the border all the way to Saigon for the Tet Offensive. And they were moving troops, they were moving supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and what we were trying to do during that early part of 67 was to catch them over there on the border and I know it irritated our officers was the fact that we were seeing all this stuff and we were reporting all this stuff, and yet the people that were making the bombing decisions weren't bombing the hell out of them. It was like they didn't believe what we were telling them. But, you know, of course, when it started, you know, a few months later, they found out all of those patrol reports that we had given them were accurate. They were hauling all of this stuff down through there. But it was tough terrain. I mean, if you just look at the maps of that part of Vietnam, these hills are just straight up and down, and I'm telling you, they'll just flat kick your butt. And you put that along with either monsoon rains or over 100 degrees with 100% humidity, or the stinking mosquitoes eating you alive. But it was, you know, it was just a tough physical something you had to endure. Of course, the North Vietnamese were facing the same thing. And, you know, a lot of North Vietnamese were captured, and they got a lot of intelligence from these guys. These were just scared kids, too. But their leadership was superior. Their operational, their control by their leaders, whether they, you know, their NCOs or their officers, was exceptional. And their soldiers were as brave as any you've ever seen. I think the biggest difference that I recognized was that, number one, how willing they were to sacrifice their men to get you to give away your crew-served weapon positions. And that was something that irritated us, but because these troops are always high on dope. In fact, we captured dope. You know, they were, one of their designated people would have a canteen full of the crap. And of course, smelling marijuana. Marijuana grew wild over there, and we could always tell when we were getting close to them. You could smell them. I mean, they were all openly smoking marijuana. So I used to tell my guys, "Good night. You smell burning rope. You know they're close."
I think. Did you watch the PBS documentary on the Vietnam War?
Yeah, I did. I wasn't really impressed by it, but I watched it.
You know, it's interesting because most of the Vietnam veterans I've spoken to have the same sentiment in that doesn't really express my experience and doesn't really express the experiences of the Marines that I fought with. And so,
no,
and so it's interesting. The one thing I thought that they did that I'd never seen was you got the perspective of the North Vietnamese soldier in a way that I'd never seen it before. And I thought that was the best part of, Listening to them talk about what it was like if you didn't get close to the Army or the Marine Corps, and they got a chance to use their supporting arms, you know, the way they described it. And then they described going back, you know, into their kind of base camps along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and guys laying in hammocks and never getting out of their hammocks, laying there and becoming psychological casualties and things like that. And which all... Go ahead.
If you think about the bombs raining down on them like they did, if you think about our H&I fire that we were constantly pounding them with, but once we got into fixed battles with them, these were good soldiers. I mean, they were highly trained, and they you rarely saw a coward. Now, now, obviously we captured a bunch that they didn't even have a weapon with them or anything, but they obviously had given up in the fight. But you could tell just from their age, they were just kids that had been drafted into service. But, you know, if you think back to that PBS special, they just gave a very glossary approach to the Vietnam. If you look at that part of Vietnam today, especially along Dong Ha Mountain, when I was in Vietnam, Dong Ha Mountain had like a triple or quadruple canopy of jungle, and they just kept spraying the thing and spraying the thing and, you know, trying to kill everything. Today, there's not a tree hardly growing on that mountain. And this is 50 plus years after they started spraying. But, you know, at the same time, I think back to when our leadership said, well, they're going to start spraying to kill the vegetation so we can see better. Well, you know, that sounded great. We all for being able to see better. But then, you know, one of these planes comes flying over us one day and man, that stuff gets on us and it's stinging our arms, it's stinging the back of our neck, you know, wherever it got on you, it's stung. And we got back and I asked, you know, is this stuff really, do we need to be out there when they're doing this? They said, oh yeah, it's perfectly safe, perfectly safe. But you know, we breathed it, we ate it, we drank it. I've got a picture of a couple of those C-123s flying over us, spraying that crap right over our position. So, I think Agent Orange is something that so many of my guys that have now died since the war, they're dying from this lung disease that it's not from smoking, it's something that's eating the outer layer of their lung, and they're literally just suffocating to death. It's pitiful. It's really pitiful. But, you know, we'll all be dead and gone, and they'll finally say, well, that Agent Orange was some really bad stuff.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding, and no, it's just those stories are awful. The Marines and soldiers and, you know, the Navy, the Blue Water Navy guys are now trying to finally get somebody to say, yeah, if you guys handled that stuff, it's probably why you guys are so sick. You know, if the ordnance guys that filled up the bombs and filled up the canisters that did, you know, the aviation stuff component with it. And also transported it, you know. There might be a reason.
Oh, yeah.
There might be a reason that you guys are sick.
Well, if you see all of the deformities from the Vietnamese children that are over there now, you know, my company, India Company 39, the men from my company, we donated money to build a school in Da Nang. And we built that school for one reason, and that was for those children. You know, the war is over, and those kids didn't have a thing to do with it. But our company, you know, wanted to do something, because you start seeing kids that don't have an opportunity to learn. Well, yeah, it is a communist school. But at least if they're in school, they're going to learn something. And I think they're starting to understand over there that capitalism is a whole much better way to go than communism is. But there's still, from what people that have been back over there tell me, big difference between North Vietnam and South Vietnam even today.
Even today, wow. Wow. Interesting. My guest is Jack Riley. He's a former squad leader in India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. And we're about to talk about the Battle of Gitlin's Corner. Now, Jack, you've got a map that everybody is looking at. And the only modification I've made to the map is I took that green thing that has the list of all the units that were part of where the company CP was located, and I moved that to the lower left-hand corner so it doesn't get in the way of anything. So we're going to talk about so there's a map, so everybody click on that map and have the map open as you listen to Jack talk about the events of 29th and 30th of March in 1967. Talk about the operation itself. You guys briefed it, and what were you guys going out to do, and what did you think you were gonna bump into?
Well, earlier in the day, this was, I believe, March the 28th, the skipper issued a warning order, and the warning order was in response to contact that First Battalion 9th Marines had been having out in the area that we were going to go to. Again, this was kicking off Operation Prairie 3, and there was a everything from a battalion to a regiment had been reported as being in that area attempting to move to the south of Compiègne and cut off the resupply road that went from Camlot, resupplying Compiègne by truck every day. And so that was, that was the order that went out. Well, later in the day, after the skipper had met with the platoon commanders and had, well, firstly, he met with the S3, and I assume the battalion commander was in that meeting, but and the skipper was told how we were to do this. The operation initially was supposed to be two companies from 3-9, India Company and my company, as well as one company that was attached to us, and if my memory serves me, it was Echo 2-9. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's who it was. But we were to be moving parallel, but several clicks apart. And India Company was to be to the west. And unlike the other two companies, India Company each night was going to split up into platoon-sized ambush positions, and get this, we were not to dig in because they didn't want us making any noise. Well, this is very strange. I mean, for all of us that have been in contact with the enemy and in battles, this just didn't sound legit. But, hey, that was the S3's order, and the skipper was a good Marine officer, and he said, "Aye, sir," and the way we went. So we let me back up, because this only happened during one time during my entire time in Vietnam. There's been a dump truckload of dirt piled up right next to the CP, and that dirt was there to fill sandbags to help protect because all we had up there on that Camp Carroll at that time were GP tents. And so right before we start getting ready to find out about what's going on, the skipper gets up on top of this pile of dirt and has the whole company come together. And the skipper told us what we were going to, where we were going and what we were going to be doing. And that 1-9 had been in this battle and had taken a bunch of casualties. And he said, contact with the enemy is guaranteed 100%. I never had a CO say that. But the skipper said, this is what we're going to do. You get ready. Leaders, get your men ready, because we're going to go up there and kick their butt. Well,
Jack, let me stop you. Looking at the map, there's an area, I think, that you were just referred to, and that is an area where 1-9 had been in a fight that's southeast of Hill 70. Is that the same?
Right.
Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, that's where 1-9 had been in contact with them the previous week. Yeah.
Okay, you can see it's a red circle just south of Hill 70. It says 1-9 fight week earlier. So they had gotten a pretty big fight. So you'd never heard that before, and never heard that after that.
I never had a skipper stand on a pile of dirt and announce to the entire company. You know, of course, we knew every day we went out we might get into something, but here was our commanding officer, and you know, I could sense from the way he was talking that, you know, there was something about this that he wasn't happy about. And, it wasn't easy. I mean, it wasn't that difficult to figure out what it was. And that was that, we were going to split up into nighttime ambushes out here. I mean, having that few of people, when you're up against these mainline NBA forces that don't ever attack unless they outnumber you about 10 to 1. So, you know, that was what was leading up to it. So we're at Camp Carroll. Later, all of us get our camouflage paint on, and you know, we carry as much ammo as we can. I'm, as a squad leader at that time, I was carrying an M79, and I had 60 rounds of AG in some old satchel charge bags that I carried. And, you know, routinely you wouldn't be carrying 60 rounds, but, hey, we knew we were getting into it. All of my men carried more ammo than they normally would be expected to carry. The skipper told us something else, too, that kind of got everybody's attention. He said, in this operation, there'll be no medevacs for heat casualties. Anybody that's a heat case or, you know, now, you know, we're talking life or death here, some of these guys. And
okay, talk to us, Jack, about the conditions. How hot, how much humidity? It's March. I've never been to Vietnam, so I'm not exactly sure what March means relative to weather. So talk to us about the elements, as long as you talk about the heat.
Well, it was unusual. It was March. But the heat was up over 100 degrees and the humidity was 100%. And, of course, water rationing was so important because, typically most Marines only had 2 canteens and the only time you were able to get more than that was when one of your buddies got wounded or something and you kept his gear and you kept his canteens. But, you'd run out of water real easy. I cautioned my men to only drink a cap full at a time. And, during this time, we did run out of water. In fact, on March the 30th, we were completely out of water all day long. But we did finally come to a creek. Well, it wasn't really a creek. It was just this little stream. It wasn't the cleanest water in the world, but it was wet. So we had our fire teams, you know, one man fill up the canteens for all of his fire team and did that while we set up security around that position. Well, after we got the whole company resupplied with water and everybody put their halazone tablets in, we moved up this stream a little ways and found a couple of dead NVA soldiers laying upstream of where we had just got our water. So I told everybody just they had another halazone tablet because wasn't nobody pouring their water out. When you're that thirsty, trust me, you'll drink. Men that are this thirsty, they'll drink muddy water. I've seen them do it. I've done it. But it was hot. It was so hot, and I really felt sorry for the new guys in particular because, you know, it took a while to get acclimated to Vietnam and the heat and humidity and carrying such heavy, heavy loads. And, but, hey, that was it.
Were you wearing your flak jackets at the time?
Yeah, they made us wear them.
Wow.
That was something that started after the September battle the previous year. We didn't wear helmets. We didn't wear flak jackets because we didn't think they'd do any good. But to be honest with you, at Gatlin's Corner, I was thankful I had my flak jacket on. I know that Lieutenant Dan Fultz told me that after the battle, after he saw me, my flak jacket was just annihilated from all of the shrapnel that had hit me in that flak jacket. And that's, you know, I have no doubt I'd never would have survived that battle if I hadn't had that flak jacket on. But, you know, they were heavy, they were hot, everybody complained about them. But that was one time that we were mighty proud to have them.
Talk to me about the operations during the morning of the 30th. So you've gone out, you're essentially doing movement to contact. The night of the 29th, did you set in platoon size ambushes? You talked about it. So you did that, and that's you were not allowed to dig in and do that. You wake up the morning of the 30th, and then what happens?
Well, the morning of the 30th, we start moving forward, and of course, let me back up to the 29th. We're already seeing scouts from the NDA. And
explain what that means. You're seeing scouts. So what does that mean? What were you actually seeing?
Well, the NVA, just like we would do, they typically would deploy scouts ahead of their either movement or positions, or they just like to deploy a lot of scouts at different positions to radio movement that they see. So we had all along the column, they started seeing these. And in fact, the right guy for us, who was new to the country, he turned around and said, what color uniforms do the North Vietnamese wear? And we said, well, they wear whatever they can get. They wear khaki, they wear green, they wear Marines uniforms that they've taken off of dead bodies. They wear Marine boots if they find small enough. You know, they wear whatever. He said, well, I just saw three over there in that tree line, three wearing khaki uniforms. Well, the NVA knew we were out there. They had been following us the whole time, and here our S3 back in the rear saying, don't dig in at night so they won't know where you are. You know, that's kind of stupid.
And it's... All right, it's, you know, it's heartbreaking because somebody sitting back there is going to tell you who's out there what to do, especially not digging in when you know that they have an indirect fire capability that can be lethal. It's just wrong as wrong could be, Jack. And
oh yeah,
that decision is to be made by the company commander in conjunction with the battalion commander, but ultimately that company commander is responsible for those Marines, and that's his call. It's just heartbreaking when you hear that kind of stupid, ignorant stuff that leads to people getting killed. So keep going.
Well, that day as we're moving forward, and you know, we're seeing these scouts, we get to a position there where we fill up the canteens, and my squad is up close to the CP, close enough for me to hear the skipper. And he's obviously talking to battalion, and so I had my radio operator just click over to the battalion net, and so I could hear what was going on. And the skipper, I mean, it's no secret, we all knew what our networks were. So, but the skipper was trying to convince the battalion commander to allow him to keep company together because of all these sightings that we were seeing. And the battalion commander and the S3 just totally dismissed it. Just totally. Now the battalion commander, remember the battalion commander is in the field with my company. But the S3, he's the guy calling the shot. I mean, they wasn't no ifs, ands, and buts about it. He was the guy calling the shots and refused to allow the skipper, to the point that they threatened to take his command away. I heard Butch Neal tell you the same thing the other day, that you know, the battalion had threatened Captain Gitlin. And Captain Gitlin was a good Marine. He's a career Marine. And he followed orders, you know, sir, and, you know, moved forward. But he didn't like it. He didn't like it a little bit. And, of course, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And just as Butch said, sometimes you say, aye, sir, and you still do what you know is best. But in that situation, the skipper was so concerned that if they didn't move out to the pre-designated, and these were pre-designated by S3, mind you, ambush sites, that, you know, had they not moved there, then they may have got some H&I fire on them or what has it, they won't lose their own men that way. But as we're moving towards Hill 70, the skipper brings all of the commanders in and tells them where they're to go and what they're to do, and he sends Lieutenant Pulse up to make sure Lieutenant Pulse in fact selects the position that we set the CP group in up on Hill 70, and to be honest, it was the only defensible position that was really in that area. Even though the grass caused all the problems as far as being allowing them to literally crawl into our positions. But, you know, we were outnumbered to the point that, and when you see as many pre-served weapons as I saw, and when you see the enemy with a tripod-mounted 51 caliber anti-aircraft gun, you're not dealing with a company.
No, you know, that's normally, that weapon system normally reserved for a little bit more than a company. Probably, I'm not that familiar with the TE of an NVA battalion in 1967, but I would think that you're dealing with at least a battalion. Possibly weapons from the regimental level as well. So talk to us about Gitlin gets his order. Captain Type gets his order, and then Butch Neal talked about the orders group that he attended and the discussion about should we do that. Were you a part of that
No, I was an observer, because remember, my squad was up at that point at the time. Of course, the company is still in a defensive position while we were getting water.
Right.
And, so they're having this meeting there, this is prior to us moving up towards Hill Captain, you know, once he gave, told the lieutenants, what they were to do, he assessed the situation. I think he assessed it right on the money that, it looked like where the first platoon was going to be going, which was to our west, a distance of 900 meters. And with the trails that were up through that area and as open and as fast as somebody could move through that area, that might be the more dangerous position, because there were a couple of major trails going through there, north-south trails, I mean, that the NBA used. And also, I think he accurately assessed the fact that the NBA would try to reinforce any attack on our flank by a trail crossing that he sent Lieutenant Fulks and our first squad, along with one of our guns and one of the rocket team members, too. And I think he accurately assessed that. And now looking over at third platoon to our east, his idea there was that, again, that was the ambush site picked out by Esprit, but it was also a perfect situation that the NBA could reinforce an attack on our east flank. And, in fact, the NBA, having watched us, you know, for the last 2 days, this being the third day, they never saw third platoon move out of their sight. And so they didn't know where the third platoon was. They just assumed it was us on the hill and first platoon out there, and it ended up that the third platoon were able to actually move up the NBA flank and just really put a hurt on their flank. So there were some terrific Marines over there in that third platoon. Of course, I've been told by those guys that were a couple of them that were decorated that what happened. I wasn't an eyewitness to what happened, but obviously anything they did was helping us up on that hill.
Right.
And then the same thing with first platoon. Of course, when the battle was initiated from those first three NBA soldiers that walked out around the bomb crater, really the battle, all hell broke loose there. You know, it was kind of like Dan Port said from a distance. He said it sounded like a Marine Corps mad minute, and all Marines know what that is.
Right.
Lieutenant Prickett and Lieutenant Gall, both from 1st and 3rd platoons, were trying to radio back to the skipper, but the skipper told both of them to just stay where they were, that we had the situation, he thought, you know, under control there. And we did, because this is what's strange. The only time I ever saw this happen is
Well, okay, hold on a second. So if you're looking at your map, right, if we go from left to right or from west to east, where you see 1st platoon is the point that they were supposed to be at. And so 1st platoon is moving. So they're between probably 500 and 1,000 meters away from Hill 70 to the southwest, going through a bunker complex that was on their map, en route to their platoon ambush. 2nd platoon minus, so Jack is part of 2nd platoon. So there's one infantry squad and then a rocket team, machine gun, and so that mix heads due west and you see where their point is, and then you see third platoon, and they're about a kilometer away to the east at that trail intersection. So all that is sitting on your map, and so you see the NVA attack come out of the north. Talk to me about other than seeing those three NVA soldiers. Had you made contact at all during the course of the day?
No contact until the first rounds were not fired until, you know, just before it started to get dark.
Okay. Next question for you. You're starting to set in your defense. Jack, could you describe your defense that you guys are putting in that night?
We moved down. We figured that if they were going to attack, if they were going to attack in force, we needed to, you know, be able to obviously defend that sector that I was given. But, I wanted to have a good visual view of that front because they could really move fast across those, old abandoned, rice paddies that were now just dry fields. They could get to us real quick. And, but trying to dig in on that hill, I'm telling you, the dirt on that hill was almost, it felt like concrete because it reminds me of church. Most people may not know what church is, but church, very difficult to dig, very hard. And, so guys, if they were able just to get a dent in the ground, that's about all they could do. Mainly because we just didn't really have time. Once we got on that hill, I gave my guys, I said, eat your chow while you can right now. And that didn't mean sit down and cook a meal. It meant open up a can and eat what's in it right now. I had one of my guys, that he wanted to go just a few yards to my right, to the east. There was a tree that he spotted that had a bunch of berries on it. He wanted to go pick him a handful of berries. And I said, well, yeah, but, you know, get right back. Well, so he's over there picking him some berries. And we're getting the platoons set in. And boom, 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 we hear four shots. And those four shots, they'd kill three NVA. And, man, they had no sooner hit the ground and... we've had mortars dropping in the tubes. You know, if you've been a Marine in battle, you know what that sounds like.
Yeah, you don't ever forget it. You could also tell if it's pointed at you or not, simply by the sound.
The mortars are only about 150 yards to our north, but we can't see them. Because of where they've got them set in.
Okay, so as we look at the position, you have if we talk about a circular defensive position atop that hill, you have what part of the circle? What part of the pie do you have? If 12 o'clock is facing north, there, Judge.
Yeah, I've got the north. Corporal Larkin has just to my left flank. And then the weapons, Marines have the rear and joining in with my right flank.
Okay, so you have, you have from like 10 to 2 on the clock. Larkin's to your west. He has from like 2 to 6. And then from 6 to joining in your right flank, that's the weapons platoon, and there's some headquarters guys there. That's the rest of those guys that are filling in the line there, yes?
That's correct.
Okay. So, but the attack. So, and the other thing I want you to do is describe the terrain. So, you talked about there's dry rice paddies, but there's elephant grass there that provides the MDA with concealment, and you can't see through it. So, you're up on a hilltop. So, is the visibility intermittent? How do they get that? How do they get close to you guys?
Well, if you look on the map, of course, it just shows that it's all wooded, but that was, that whole Hill 70 was covered in elephant grass. And the elephant grass was anywhere from 4 feet high to over your head. And it was just intermittent all over that hill, but, the dry paddies, now, the elephant grass hadn't grown as high. We could actually see the enemy as they entered that rice paddy on line. And, but once the mortars started to drop on us, and unfortunately, as mortars do, wounded a lot of Marines right off the bat. The NVA actually, as they would do, you know, the NVA walked the mortars over us, and they walked them from east to west,
right,
along the axis of the hill.
So they land first round's impact off to your right flank, and they walk them back across the top of the hill.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And then they tried to send enough infantry to just overrun us, but these first guys were obviously under the influence of some kind of drugs. For my guys, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, and I told every one of my guys, just hold them and squeeze them, because it's the first time we'd ever seen the enemy actually try a frontal assault against us, and we were filling up that rice paddy with dead NVA. Well, during this time, the Lieutenant Cricket and Lieutenant Gall were in radio contact with the skipper, and the skipper told them at that time they were both wanting to know if they should come back to our position.
Right.
But the skipper told him to hold the position right then because I believe he thought we had the thing under control.
Okay.
And could handle it. But I don't think any sooner than he got those words out of his mouth that then the next mortar barrage started. They were checkerboarding the hill then, and they walked mortars through their own infantry. I mean, it was the worst case of fire control that I've ever seen, but they didn't mind killing their own people, and that told me they had a bunch of them in reserve over there.
Okay.
So from that point on, it was just an all-out battle.
Okay, so and the attack comes from 12 o'clock. Yes, it comes through the elephant grass and on the map from 12 o'clock. Yes,
that's correct. That's correct, and the bad thing for us is that some of these Vietnamese were such small people. We captured a couple of them that I believe they weren't any more than 4 feet tall. I think they were tiny guys, but they were able to maneuver and slip through that grass and had to have obviously been pre-positioned in that grass, because at this time now we're in an all-out grenade battle. I mean, we've got Chi-Coms coming at us, and we're throwing M-26s at them, and my squad at this point in the battle, we're killing NVA in a 360 degrees. They're all over us.
So the first wave hits, the mortars are walked across your position, you're killing them, and they just keep coming, and now it's a close fight, hand-to-hand fight. Describe the fight for us.
Oh, yeah, it got to be hand-to-hand. Thank goodness import teams and the, you know, that old sound of fixed bayonets that most guys think they'd never ever hear. But, no, I mean, I told my guys, I said, don't try to stick them, shoot them. So, it was, I was very, very proud of my guys. I had, during this part of the battle, I had one of my men get a mortar shrapnel in his neck. And, I don't know if, for anybody in your audience that's ever been wounded by a mortar shrapnel, you know how it burns like the dickens. And, and it being in his neck, it was just literally frying his skin. And, he was really in distress from it and losing blood. And, so obviously I had to get my corpsman, on him. And my corpsman's name was Ken Braun. He was 18 years old at the time. And, Doc Braun, took the Marine and took him back up the hill to where our senior corpsman was, Chuck Dockery, and they were going to set up a place there, a more secure place, so we could put our wounded. And, of course, at this point in the battle, my squad, even though we're the most exposed, area down there, we're not suffering too many casualties. You know, I think most of us at this point had either a grenade or a mortar wound of some type, but we're still all in the fight. And, this Marine that had the neck wound, you know, that was a life-threatening wound. We had to get him some care real quick.
Right.
I will say this, though, about my corpsman. During this entire battle, he treated just about everybody on that hill, and I recommended him for the Medal of Honor. And, you know, how some, decorations or recommendations happen or go in the Marine Corps, you know, it just got dropped or lost or whatever. But, you know, Doc never got a decoration of any kind other than, you know, he and I talked after about 30 years and I said, Doc, what decoration did you get for Gatlin's Corner? And his answer was, well, I got another Purple Heart just like you did. And, but I knew at that point we had to do something and, he didn't know it, but since I had recommended him, the Marine Corps allowed me to then resubmit my recommendation. And, then once they got it in Washington, they gave it to the Navy, and the Navy slept on it for a couple of years. Of course, Admiral Borda during that time committed suicide, and we know that slowed it up. But when it came back from the Navy, it was not the Medal of Honor, but it was the Navy Cross. And, but Doc saved a lot of lives, and we were able to, have him decorated at, Iwo Jima Monument in Washington there, or in Alexandria. After about 36 years, he finally got the Navy Cross.
That's a great story. Jack, talk to me about, you're in the midst of this fight, right? Now it's a close fight. When do you know Captain Gitlin is wounded? And the commander element, your forward air controller is, I believe he's killed pretty early in the fight. Talk to us about the, and now you're going to be one of the senior guys, there on top of that hill. Talk to us about, did you know Captain Gitlin had been hit? Talk to us, tell us the story of Lieutenant Bobo. He was, obviously certainly, you had worked with him so closely as one of his squad leaders, and now he's there as the weapons platoon commander. Talk to us about the command element, and then talk to us about Lieutenant Bobo.
Well, I guess, let me start with Captain Pappas, Barney Pappas was, Barney had just joined us, think this was his, actually his first time to go out with us. And, Barney had just come from, he was a A6 pilot, and he had just been awarded the I can't even think of the name of the medal right now.
The Air Medal?
But no, it's higher than that. It's just under, what's just under the Bronze Star?
The Distinguished Flying Cross.
The Distinguished Flying Cross, or whatever that was. I am close air support to a group of Marines that were trapped on this hill and couldn't get any help or support, and Barney flew in there and just tore up the enemy that allowed that group of Marines to escape the hill. But anyhow, Barney, this is his first time out with us. For you listeners that don't know this, Marine Corps pilots, they spend half of their tour in the air, and then they became forward air controllers with the grunts on the ground. So a lot of people wonder why the pilots wear their camouflage covers on their helmets. But, I mean, there's a very close relationship between Marine Corps pilots and the grunts. But Captain Pappas, he had all his radio operators with him, and these mortars that were shooting at us were coming from an area to our northeast, and he was trying to move down the slope of the hill just enough so he could get a better view. He had already called in to get air on station. But just as he was trying to vector them into the target, he's shot and killed. And in fact, he had moved down so far that his whole team got overrun, and two of his radio operators were captured and tied them up with comm wire. But with nobody then to guide the air into the targets, we had air on station, but we had no air support whatsoever at that time in the battle. Well, so Captain Pappas is killed, and then Captain Gatlin, my position got to a point where it was just untenable where we were. I had to move back. We didn't have any radio contact at that point because the NVA were scrambling our frequency. All we were getting was a bunch of static. As soon as you fail back to your fallback channel, you know, they were immediately on it as well. So I started putting my meter and setting up a tighter perimeter, and I moved to the CP to see the skipper. And, of course, now this is probably an hour or so in the battle, I guess. See the skipper, I see the first sergeant, and the skipper realized, I think, at that point that the FAC team had been overrun, and at this point, I really wasn't aware of what was happening with Lieutenant Bobo. I became aware later. As the situation grew worse, though, I mean, the maids were just going back and forth, and one of my guys said, you know, there were a whole lot more green pressures coming at us than there were red pressures going out at them. And he was right at that point because they had employed three machine guns that we could see. And each squad carried three balls, one per fire team. That's a shoulder fired rocket.
Right.
So I took the three calls from each of my fire teams that moved to a position and fired one round into each of those three guns. Well, it knocked those three guns out, but it didn't take the NGA but just a few minutes, and they had those guns going again. And I thought, surely to goodness, you know, it can't be the same gun. And that, you know, was another clue to me that we were up against a much larger force. So they start laying down fire again. So at that point, I used all 90% of my HE rounds firing M79 rounds at those three guns. Well, I silenced two of them, but one of the guns I couldn't silence. I mean, I shot everything I had on that gun, and I just couldn't silence that gun. And it was going to take a rocket to take them out, and I didn't have another rocket. And so that's really when we start pulling back up the hill, because we just were defenseless down there against those guns. And so we get up to that tighter position, and I see the skipper, and the skipper's been wounded, but it's just shrapnel wounds. I mean, at this point in the battle, most of us that I think were in leadership positions had already been wounded by something, whether it were gunshots or mortars or Chi-Com grenades. And, you know, fortunately, they kept shooting these RPGs over there, but they, you know, whoever they had shooting them, thank goodness, they weren't very good, so RPGs never were on target. But the skipper, once I got back up there, the skipper ordered me to attack back over the hill to the northwest. Now then I realized that John Bobo had been wounded, severely wounded. Doc Braun was there at the CP, and of course, you know, if Lieutenant Bobo's wounded, we got to get him. We had already had a rocket team on that left flank that had been completely overrun. All of members of that team had been killed. One of our corpsmen, David Mitchell, he had to actually play dead under one of the bodies to keep from getting shot in the head. They were shooting all the wounded in the head. And so David just had to lay there. Also, one member of a mortar team that had gone over to support the rockets, name was Randy Plumley, and Randy was captured. He'd been shot through the arm, he'd been shot through the side, and they captured him, and they didn't kill him because he had a map in his pocket, so they thought he was an officer, so they didn't shoot him. So they tied him up with comm wire, and Randy, during this whole battle, Randy told me later, he said, well, he said, Riley, I'm laying there. I got an NVA standing over me with an AK-47. And, I'm watching the whole battle take place. And he said, on command, I'm hearing the NVA officer yell something. And they all stand up at one time and start shooting into y'all. Or said that they'll all on command at one time throw grenades at you. He said, I knew y'all were in big trouble when y'all stopped throwing grenades at him, and I saw an E-2 come flying through their air at him. So Randy, fortunately, we were able to get, well, actually, all three of the guys that had been captured, we were able to get back into our perimeter later in the battle. But Lieutenant Bobo, you know, I just can't say enough about him. What he did, you know, I found out, you know, and you just tactically look at what happened. had it not been for Lieutenant Bobo, my left flank where he was at the time, my left flank would have just been rolled up. And John had this, he had a pump of shotgun, which was an old Mossberg 500 pump shotgun, and he was carrying the solid ass, double aught buck, shells. And I don't know how many he had. He had a bag full of them, I guess. And, but John, when the rocket team got knocked out, he moved down there to try to set up another rocket team. And, that's when the second mortar barrage came in, and that mortar barrage blew off his leg right just below his knee, and literally was just a sinew of tissue holding that, you know, onto his body. But you know, they tried to put a tourniquet on it, and but he just stuffed his leg down in the dirt and kept shooting at the NBA with that shotgun. And trust me, a double-aught buck in a hand-to-hand situation could do an awful lot of damage, and John was killing a whole bunch of them. And, you know, but he was holding that whole position over there. Well, when the skipper told, he didn't tell me, he ordered me to attack to the northwest, and then Pop Rogers told me that Lieutenant Bobo was over there and he was hurt. So I took my squad. At this point, I had one of my guys was hurt bad, another guy was wounded pretty bad. There was two Marines, John Laurinaitis, who was actually a mortarman, but he was serving as like the company driver or company runner at that time. He joined with my squad, and one of the rocket Marines by the name of Wallace Williams, he joined with my squad, and we counterattacked back over that hill to get Mr. Bobo. Doc Braun is with us, and we dropped Doc Braun off with Mr. Bobo, and Doc immediately puts a web belt on his leg, and he cinches that belt till it's his thigh was no bigger than my wrist, and I mean, steel bleed. And, of course, John kept trying to keep his leg just stuck in the dirt to help control the bleeding. But John was really trying to get us just to leave him there. And he would hold the position while we pulled back. But Doc told him real quick, you know, it wasn't no work like that. So the objective was for Doc to pull John back over the crest of the hill, which was about 15 meters from where we were, and that I was going to lay down a base of fire to the front to protect him while he did that. And so when we moved forward to lay down that base of fire, one of the NBA machine guns that just opened up, and John Laurinaitis, or Jack as we called him, he just went straight at the machine gun. I mean, Jack was going to take that gun out, and unfortunately Jack was killed in that. But Jack had done so many things in that battle that prior to him joining up with my squad that he was awarded a Navy Cross posthumously. Wallace Williams was also killed in that counterattack, so during that one time there right there on the front of the hill, I lost six men that were with my squad that night. When Doc finally started dragging Mr. Bobo up the hill, I was facing the north as we were laying down this base fire, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden I hear a AK-47 behind me on full automatic, and I just turned and instinctively shot him. He, you know, it was an NVA, and I just thought, you know, it's another one. They were popping up all over the place, so that was one more that was dead. But I didn't realize it at the time that he had shot and killed Mr. Bobo, and he had shot Doc Braun three times. Doc was still alive, though, and later in the he was hauled up right in front of me in my position, and I pulled him over into where we were, and as all corpsmen are prone to think, grunts don't know how to treat wounds, but here I am trying to put patches, about half a Doc's back was shot off, his whole spine's exposed, and here he is telling me how to put a bandage on his wound, and I literally was having to take bandages off of some of my Marines that had been killed to put them on Doc because we'd run out of bandages a long time ago. But here Doc Braun was, I mean, he never moaned or cried or anything. And he's the toughest guy I've ever seen in my life. But here he was, you know, he's finally down. But boy, did he ever save a bunch of lives that night.
Talk to me about, you're a corporal squad leader, right? And you've never been in a fight like this. What went through your head? Did you think that you were going to lose a position? Did you think you were all going to die? What was going through your head? You're seeing your platoon commander now is now dead. Your company commander is wounded. The FAC is dead. What's going through your head as a squad leader?
Well, you know, it was all happening so fast that, you know, right when the battle first started, anybody that says they're not afraid in combat is just out and out lying. And everyone was afraid. But, you know, the battle got to going, you know, I told my wife, I just had a peace come over me that hey, you just do what you've been trained to do and, you know, go to the next, you just keep doing whatever you do, just don't give up, don't quit. And that's what every guy in my squad was doing. I mean, they were all giving it everything they had, and we get back all the way around. You know, one of the things that I was supposed to do as well is to recover Mr. Bobo, but to also recover any other wounded that may be out there on the northern slope of the hill. So I take my squad all the way back down to where our original position was.
Hold on now, Jeff. Your squad now, your squad now consists of how many?
Let's see. Of my original, we're down to nine now, the original squad.
Okay, of the original squad, you're down to, is that nine counting,
yeah.
Counting you or not counting you?
Yeah, counting me, there's still nine of us.
Okay, so you move back down to where your original position is. Now, let me ask you this, is Captain Gitlin still alive at this point?
Well, I don't know
we
at
don't
this
know.
Point.
At this
no,
point,
I don't know.
The last you had seen him, he was alive. He had shrapnel wounds,
yeah,
and he was alive. Okay.
Correct. The last time I saw him, he was still alive. I was missing, well, I said nine. Actually, I'd make that eight. Because one of my men, Pasquale Gigliotti, And yes, he is the tag.
I was going to say.
But Gig is missing, and I don't know where he is. His fire team leader don't know where he is. And you know, I'm desperate. I'm trying to, you know, you don't want to lose contact with your men. And, so I take my squad back down and we sweep around, you know, trying to find anybody, but in particular, I'm looking for Gigliotti. Well, Gigliotti had actually been shot, and he'd been shot a couple of times, and his pain was so intense that he just passed out. He just, you know, he was unconscious from the pain. And we make our sweep all the way back around up to where the CP is, and the CP is now more heavily involved in a grenade battle than they were when I left there, you know, earlier in the battle. And now when I get up there, the skipper is dead, and the first sergeant had been shot through the femur. One of those NVA soldiers popped up out of the grass and shot him right through the femur. And he had this gigantic hole right through his leg, and naturally the leg's broken there. And so he is out of commission from a mobility standpoint, but, you know, his main purpose at that point was keeping us in radio contact with battalion and with the other two platoons. But anyhow, we get them back. There was a depression on the south side of that hill that was obviously left over from the old French and, you know, the Vietnam era days. But we were using that as the place to put the most serious wounded people if it offered the most protection. And that place was, you know, quickly filling up with, you know, very serious wounded Marines. And in fact, I saw a count that said, we had 57 wounded. There were 15 killed in all, and the 57 were wounded, but now that 57 also included the first and third platoon, so I don't know exactly how many we had wounded, right there on the hill. But when we pulled back and got Pop Rogers in that, place where he was, had some protection there, and a couple of the Marines managed to get some bandages. Actually, they were run all the way through his leg, you know, in one side and out the other,
right,
trying to stop his bleeding. And, but once we got back to that position, it was pretty obvious at that point. My concern was, you know, our flanks and, more so, ammunition. And we were running low on ammo quick, and I had no idea if we were going to get any help or support. And, because to this point in the battle, we had not had a single round of incoming artillery to help us, nor did we have any air support. So the Top Rogers was on the radio, and he got on the air net, and he was literally begging for somebody to come and help us. Of course, artillery wouldn't shoot because, you know, air was on station. When Top was trying to get somebody to come in, it got to the point in the battle that we were just pulled into this, what I call the briar patch. It was a area on the hill that you wouldn't really want to walk through because it had so many briars in it, and it really would tear your skin up pretty good. But we got our wounded into that briar patch, and we pulled our defensive perimeter back into that area. And, but I could tell the NVA were about to plan what looked to me like they were just going to try to overrun us with another company. And, just because of the way things were shaping up there on the hill. And, you know, just about that time, here's Doc Braun, who I didn't know where he was. By this time, you know, it's dark. And, but here Doc Braun crawls up right in front of me. And I mean, of course, every one of us were covered in blood from head to toe. I'd just been out to pull, me and my radio operator had just come back from pulling our other corpsman, Doc Dockery, who had been shot 6 times. He ultimately lost both legs, but he was still alive. I mean, and get this, he shot in both arms, and we pulled him into the perimeter, and Doc says, "Riley, lay me next to somebody I can help." And I'm thinking, good night, Doc. I'm thinking you're about to die. And here you are saying, put me next to somebody I can help. I mean, where do you find these guys? You know, these are just fantastic men. But we get Doc Braun patched up. He had one ampule of morphine left. So he shot himself with it because, trust me, I mean, anybody been shot 3 times like he had, twice through the chest and once across his shoulder, that just ripped his whole back open, exposing his spine, and he was just a bloody mess. So, Top's literally begging for somebody to come and help us because I did a quick survey of our guys to see how much ammo we had. We only had about 20 rounds to the man left. And at that time, one of the huge gunships came on station. It was from VMO-2 out of Dong Ha. The first pilot in, he was Captain Chris Bradley. And I'll tell you right now, were it not for Chris coming through there, and he made 3 scraping runs against that reserve NVA company, and with all the rockets he had and all the machine guns ammo that he had, and that literally broke their back at that point. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the second pilot's name, but it was 2 gunships. But both of them, I knew at that point I'd never ever forget their call sign. Their call sign was Deadlock Playboy. And the VMO2 guys, I told them one time on radio that if we ever got together, India Company would buy them all the beer they could drink. So. But they were fantastic.
Is that the first fire support that you got all day, Jack?
That's it. That was the first fire support that we got. Had we not got it right then and there, we would have been overrun. And we didn't have the ammo to fight. We had, like I said, the guys that were still able to shoot, we had about 20 rounds per man, 1 magazine per man, and 20 rounds don't last long when you fight the company. Then after that helicopter, after VMO2 came in there and broke up that final assault, they started to, you know, hitting us, dropping mortars again. And of course, I'm thinking at this time, well, goodness, they just took a pounding. So when they started dropping mortars, but it wasn't like a typical mortar attack where you're bracketing people. It was just more like harassing mortars. And so we're laying there in this depression waiting for the NBA to come at us. And it's so pitch dark, you can't see anything. And Doc Rogers still, he's got a AK-47 that he picked up off the ground. And lo and behold, old Dave Underwood from our first platoon, first squad, comes wandering up there on the hill trying to find us. And he came within inches of top just blowing him away because we couldn't see. We couldn't tell who they were. But boy, have we never been so happy to see another bunch of Marines in our life. But the first platoon had finally been able to get to us, and that's when Butch brought the first platoon back over there, and then Butch started calling in fire on the NBA. But yeah, that gunship showing up from VMO2 was the first support we had, and the top got the Navy Cross as he should have, and it was you know, him on that radio, staying on that radio, letting everybody know what was happening to us. But there were some awful brave Marines that, number one, that gave their life on that hill, but there were a lot of brave Marines that fought trying to get to them and save them. And of course, you know, as Butch mentioned, there were really three battles going on. Third platoon was fighting their battle, and first was fighting theirs, and then we were fighting the main attack on the hill.
At what point do you find out that Captain Bedlin's dead?
When I got back up there, the skipper was dead.
As soon as
I brought my squad back up the hill, then I see the skipper's dead. And the skipper had his radio operators were all just laying there about to bleed to death, and one of them said that the skipper had been picking up shotguns and throwing them back at the enemy. But during this final time before he was killed, the skipper had his own Winchester Model 12. You know, if you're familiar, that's a pump shotgun, 12-gauge shotgun.
Right.
And the skipper had some of these new, I don't know where he got them, those Flechette rounds.
Yep.
To have the darts in them. Now, you know, I kept asking, trying to get some of those for my M79, but, they would have been mighty handy up there that night, but, we didn't have anything but HE at that time for the M79, but the skipper, sadly, one time, the skipper had six dead NVA laying right in front of him that he had killed, and the shotgun, a grenade blast knocked him off his feet, and he stuck the barrel of that shotgun down in the ground, and it plugged the barrel. Then he got up and tried to shoot it again, and, you know, you can imagine what it did to the barrel. It just slipped that thing like a banana peeling. And, but he kept shooting it anyway. Top Rogers told me that, there was an NVA that just about would get the bead on top, and, the skipper shot him with that old splintered barrel and killed him. And the skipper said, you know, that thing had still worked. So, hey, he was one of the bravest people I've ever seen in my life. Captain Getlin was something else. He really, in my opinion, should have been awarded the Medal of Honor as well. But, you know, they're not going to give three Medal of Honors on one deal for one battle. Marine Corps just don't work like that. But in my opinion, he should have got it. Doc Braun should have got it. And obviously, John Bobo did get it. But Captain Getlin was a fantastic officer. had a little girl at home. His wife actually was able to sneak to Okinawa and see him just before the company left Okinawa. He wasn't supposed to do that, but I think some of the officers moved over into the batch for officers. They moved over to where the enlisted men were to give up their quarters there so the skipper and his wife could have a little privacy, but as fate would have it, that was the last time, you know, they were ever together.
My guest is Jack Riley. Jack, I want to take one more break. We'll come back and we'll finish this up. I'm curious about lessons learned and the rest of your life. But you just heard the second time from a very, very different perspective, that of a Marine infantry squad leader, the Battle of Gitlin's Corner, a battle fought at close range, a battle that was at times hand-to-hand, and for the most part, because of the way the attack unfolded, without supporting arms until the very end. We'll take a quick break. More of a battle study. The second time we visit Gitlin's Corner here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue here on a Wednesday. Mike McNamara with you, and very graciously, former Marine Sergeant Jack Riley has given up his time to spend with us talking about one of the great events of his life. So, Jack, first of all, thanks to you for taking time out of your day to talk to us. I know these things get listened to like you can't even believe. So, on behalf of all the Marines and soldiers that listen to this, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Talk to me about, first of all, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about this battle? I spent a little time with this hill in Vietnam. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that discussion about the Battle of Gitlin's Corner, especially from the perspective of the guy who led the second squad of the second platoon, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you?
Well, there was a tremendous role played by our M60 gun team. Tommy Butts, I think Tommy was a Lance Corporal at the time, and he was the team leader. He was shot, I think, about three times in the arm and almost lost his arm. And Sam Phillips was the gunner. Sam was shot right through the knee. And then that left Joe Limpa and Billy Hill to own the gun. I believe Tommy was awarded a Silver Star for trying to move down and help the rocket team when the rocket team was getting overrun. But the gun team, they had to keep moving on the hill because obviously pre-served weapons were a target.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure the RPGs were primarily trying to get them, but they kept moving the gun team. I know they moved around that hill four or five times. And, you know, my concern was always, you know, y'all just make sure you shoot high, because they were behind us as we were on the lower slope of the hill. But they were getting positioned to where they could take out, try to, you know, suppress the fire on that stinking NVA 51 caliber. You know, if you've never been shot at with a 51 caliber before, I'm going to tell you, if that don't scare you, nothing will. It makes one heck of a racket when it's going past your ears. But let me also mention the mortar guys, because, you know, as the holes were being caused in the perimeter because the guys getting hit, seriously wounded. These mortar Marines, after they shot their rounds, they were right there in the line with everybody doing everything they could. These were some fantastic guys up there. And as I said earlier, you know, a situation that was so dire that was that we were against all odds, really. But to see this group of Marines that never hesitated one time, and I can't say enough about the 1st Platoon's fight to get to us. And they did. They fought all the way to get over there to where we were. And it took them that long to get there just because the NVA had set up blocking forces. As soon as they moved to the west and 3rd Platoon moved to the east, of course, with 3rd Platoon, they didn't really know they were there until the 3rd Platoon was on their flanks. But I am so grateful to those guys because once they saw the fight on the hill and they saw us getting bombarded with all those mortar rounds and, you know, it was light mortar, and then we start having heavy mortars drop. I mean, this is just something that people don't, it was the worst battle I was ever in, and I was in a few of them over there, but being on the hill where you don't really have anything but a bunch of elephant grass as protection, it's not a very good feeling. But I just want to give those guys all the credit in the world because they were truly some fantastic Marines, and every Marine that's ever worn the uniform, I know, would be very proud of them.
When you reflect, give me a couple lessons that as a combat leader that you took away from that fight.
Well, number one, make sure your fire teams and all the members of your squad are prepared. And that's a squad leader's job. It's a squad leader's responsibility to make sure that his men are fully, you know, trained up and know what the situations are. And as one of the things that I used to do early was, you know, anytime I get a new guy, just like I was treated, I put the radio on his back. And, you know, what better way to learn radio procedure and all than have to wear the radio, and guys would ask me, well, you know, why do I need to do this? I said, well, what happens if the radio operator's killed? What happens if I'm killed? You know how to call in air support? You know how to call in mortars? You know how to call in artillery? Do you not know how to call in a medevac? You mean, all of these things you just have to impress on them, because I learned going through training myself that there were so many 18 and 19 young men that were just overwhelmed by tactics that it was just over their heads. But once you can get them in a squad where you work with them and make sure they understand it, then if you have a man go down, you got the next man up, and the next man up has to do the job, you know, with promotions in Vietnam, it's certainly different. It was different then than it is today. I look at the Marines today, and, you know, you see guys that are corporals, and they've been in 5 or 6 years. Boy, in Vietnam, it was, well, your leader goes down, another leader goes down, guess what, you're the leader. You better know what you're doing or you're going to get your men killed. So I think that lesson, and secondly, you know, And I told all the officers that we served with this, the Marine Corps needs to train the warriors for the war they're going to fight, not the war that they fought in the last war. And unfortunately, that's what we were seeing in Vietnam, was that second lieutenants were coming in. You know, they knew the basic skills and all, but guerrilla tactics were something that they were severely lacking in. And, you know, about the time we got a lieutenant trained up good, this was in the latter part of my tour, you know, they'd be transferred out and bring another new lieutenant in. You got to train another one all over again. But I think every lieutenant would tell you the same thing. You know, they got Vietnam. They obviously didn't know everything they needed to know, just like I certainly didn't. But I had good officers. I had good NCOs. My first sergeants they weren't just good. They were outstanding. Top Rogers and Bryce Lee. Top Lee. He and I worked together after I got my third Purple Heart. I used to kid him and I'd say, "Top, you know, here I am, you're my spotter." I said, "I must be the only Marine in the Marine Corps that has a first sergeant for a spotter." but he was such a character that, every guy in the outfit, You loved him, but at the same time, you knew you better do what you're supposed to do because he'd be on you in a heartbeat. And that's what a first sergeant's supposed to do. But if you're going to have a good outfit, you're going to fight. That's what happens. One other thing that I would point out in Vietnam, every time we lost somebody, the next day, it was in the past. We never talked about it. And, that may not be the best way to handle a situation. It may not be the way the Corps handles it today. But I can tell you, as, being over there and having lost, a bunch of guys in our company, that's the way we handled it. You just didn't talk about it. You went on to the next day, the next mission, the next patrol, the next operation. You just, you know, one day after the next, you do what you're supposed to do. But I think all of us that were in leadership roles tried our best to train whoever was going to take our place to do the best they could, or at least try to train the guys in our squad to be good squad leaders themselves if that situation ever arose. There's a lot of lessons learned in Vietnam, that's for sure, and hopefully our country as a whole has learned that there were many, many mistakes made in Vietnam, and I'm not talking politics now, I'm just talking about military tactically, that so many Americans died, that if we're going to war, win the war. We went to Vietnam with no intent of ever winning that war. And, 58,479 men gave their life for it, and we just walked away from it and abandoned the people that did love the country and wanted to fight for it. But politicians just decided, well, they're not going to spend another dime on it, so gave the country up to the enemy, especially after Tet, when the North Vietnamese were soundly defeated. And all we had to do was bomb Hanoi and Haiphong Harbor, and the war had been over. But I don't want to get on that soapbox.
All right. Well, we can do that a different time because I'd love to talk about the awards that come out of that. We spoke at the start of the interview. The fight at Gatlin's Corner takes place over a period of how long? How many, 6 hours did you say?
6 hours, right.
All right. And let's walk through the awards with me. Medal of Honor presented to First Lieutenant John Bobo.
No, he was the second lieutenant.
Still a second lieutenant.
Yeah, second lieutenant.
All right. And Navy Cross to...
Navy Cross awarded to Captain Mike Gatlin, First Sergeant Ray Rogers, Corporal John Laurinaitis, and our corpsman, Ian Braun.
I don't, again, I've never heard of any, I've never heard of such a thing. And so it is amazing. How, let me ask you a post-combat related mental health thing. Mental health got handled by a lot of Vietnam veterans is you come home and you stuff it in the closet, you slam the door shut, and you don't go near that doorknob or the door. You fought in some pretty intense fights. This one, I don't know that I've ever heard of a more intense one than this one. I'm sure guys who fought in 1-9. Their battles up in the DMZ had similar experiences with regular forces, not irregular forces. How did you deal with it when you came home?
Well, after I was rotated home, of course, with my 30 days leave, it was, you know, fantastic to be with my wife again and family, and then, of course, I still had some active duty time to go up at Camp Lejeune and did that. But then after I got out of the Corps, I maintained contact with several of the Marines that were still over there, you know, that were friends that we corresponded. You know, obviously, I was wanting to know casualty situations or anybody we lost, and unfortunately even some of my former squad were killed later up at Tungien, but you know, a place where I don't think gets the recognition as being was at a couple of little twin hills that, you know, a routine day up there was about 500 incoming artillery rounds. People think it's shell shock at World War One, but trust me, Contien, when we were at Contien, just briefly before, during July of 1967, right after the end of Operation Buffalo, Contien was not a place you'd even walk around. You know, you ran wherever you were going. But those guys, India Company, after I rotated in August, they went to Contien for 30 days during the month of September. And two of our guys were killed during that 30-day span. But I would venture to say that not a single person came out of that place unchanged, because you just don't withstand that many rounds bombarding you. You know, I'll be honest with you. You know, I faced the enemy face to face. The most terrifying thing that can happen to a grunt is not seeing the enemy coming at you with a rifle or a bayonet. It's that mortar round, it's that artillery round that's in the air, and you know it's heading to you, and you just pray, good Lord, let it miss our position. Because that's the scariest thing that I ever endured in Vietnam. It's not the firefights. It's not hand to hand. It's that mortar round, artillery round in the air. The guys that our artillerymen that we had in Vietnam, they were some of the finest, well-trained Marines around, because it was amazing. We learned in particular on Operation Buffalo, which was one of the largest, I guess, Marine operations, and not hardly as big as some of those right at the end, but for us, the 9th Marines, the whole 9th Marine Regiment, you know, the NVA were bringing divisions across the border at that time, and it was one heck of a battle up there as well. But as I think history has shown everybody, Bravo 19 was the one that took the brunt of that during that big ambush marketplace. But sadly, we from the India 39, we were the ones that went in there on July the 4th and recovered their bodies, put them on tanks, and carried them, and the tankers carried them back to Tonkin. Sad day to see Marines laying out like that, you know, for 2 or 3 days in over 100-degree heat. It was just a terrifying situation for those survivors from what had happened there. I think from our Marines, at least the ones that I've talked to, I think most of them handled it after the war about like, you know, I did. Several went on to get their college degrees. We had several that stayed in the Corps, made it a career, and heck, good many of them did. And I'm sure that those Marines made a big difference in the future of the Marine Corps in training Marines for the, you know, for Desert Storm and other battles to come. Many, you know, became educators. I know one member of my squad, he got his degree and became a fifth, he was American Indian, got his degree and became a fifth grade teacher. And retired as a fifth grade teacher. But, you know, each of us handling what happened to us, well, you know, it happened to us and we survived, yet we never forget. We never forget those that died. We've had numerous memorial services where we honor their memory, and we will always honor their memory. And when we wrote our book, you know, that book was to honor those men that died so that, you know, their families, their loved ones would know how bravely they fought. And they gave the right, you know, for the man on their left and right.
Jack, first of all, thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it. I think that I love doing these discussions, and I do think that people learn a lot. When a final question though for you, when you think back in terms of being a squad leader in combat and the things that make a good squad, and make a squad hard to kill, what are those things?
Well, you got to, number one, trust in your leadership. You got to have a fire team, a squad leader that knows what he's doing. And I think the way that I understand a person becomes a squad leader today, it's much more difficult to attain that title than it was for me. You know, I was fortunate to just be in with a good company and had a good CO and a good platoon leader that believed in me. And, but you know, you have to know that the person that you're following knows his stuff. And he's not just a hot dog out there. I think the Corps got rid of a lot of hot dogs, and they were. I will say that our company, we only had one, and he was exposed real quick. that was a career guy, but obviously was not qualified for the position that he had, and they got rid of him real fast. But you gotta have trust in your leadership. Secondly, I think the squad leader and fire team leaders, you've got to set the example. I mean, your men are looking at you. I don't care what you do, your men are looking at you, and they're making a judgment based on what they see. Just like I would look at a brand new lieutenant. I'm watching the guy. I'm going to watch him like a hawk because I want to know if I can trust this guy or not. But I don't think we should expect anything less than a new rifleman in a fire team. Today, with what I understand the commandant's doing with cutting the squads down and adding a technical person and having an assistant squad leader title, I don't know how all that works out. Just based on what I've read, it sounds good. I certainly hope it does. I'm not being familiar with all of the technology that's available to the O3s today. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like it. Three-man fire team, so now all of a sudden somebody gets sick, somebody gets hurt, now you've got three two-man fire teams?
Yeah, but Mike, there in Vietnam, I only had one battle, and that was Gatlin's Corner, where I had four-man fire teams.
Yeah, I agree with you, but so if you didn't have four, at least you have three. If you start with three, what do you go with, two? Here's what I've heard, Jeff, or what I think, not so much what I've heard, the commandant had to buy other things, and so we can pretty easily say, all right, it's four-man fire teams, produce an extra 700 grunts this year, and we're back to where we want to be, which would be a 12 and 3, a 15-man fire team. That, to me, makes sense. Three-man fire teams doesn't make any sense to me. So hopefully he did that so we could buy other kind of Marines that he thinks we need now, and he wasn't sure about the budget. So hopefully that will change. I just three-man fire team, and then what do we do? Now we're down to two? That's not enough ass. Your ass isn't big enough to take casualties. And what happens when somebody gets shot? Now you're done?
Well, it reminds me of a time we were at Fulock 6, and my platoon was down to two six-man squads. So you talk about being undermanned.
Right. When you start undermanned, that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing.
No, we started with more than that. It was just when you take 66 wounded, you're going to, most of your folks are not going to be able to come back.
Right.
But I agree.
Here's the one thing,
we're giving everybody an automatic rifle. That happened with the M16. When we got the M16s in Vietnam, even though they were a piece of crap, when we finally did get the things to halfway shoot, magazine, we couldn't put the 18 rounds in a magazine or it would double feed. So I would still designate who was the automatic rifleman. You can't go out there with everybody in your squad on full automatic. You're not going to last the battle if you're doing that.
Yeah, and my opinion is that if it's on full automatic, the first couple rounds might hit the target, but everything else is going high. So I think, again, I understand the concept. And if you have to do it, you have that capability, but I don't think it applies to too many situations. And I think well-aimed semi-automatic fire is what kills people historically and what will continue to kill people. You watch the guys who shoot the Kalashnikov, you know, everybody's safe after the first round gets fired because that thing goes straight up in the air. So just one.
Well, M14s did the same thing. You couldn't put, you know, I always challenged the new guy when we were doing fam fire with new guys to, you know, to get their battle sights. I always challenged them to put a full magazine in that M14 and hold it for all 20 rounds. You knew that sucker was going to be pointing at the moon before he got through.
No, I understand that it's an option if you need it. And you can put out a lot of rounds if you have to. I wouldn't do it that often. But I understand the capability. And again, I think that for a long time we've punished infantrymen, and not bought them the equipment they should have because everybody's got to have it. Well, everybody's not an infantryman. Okay. Everybody gets rifleman training. I got that. But let me tell you, there's a different skill set to fight at Gatlin's Corps. And so when we say every Marine's a rifleman, we ought to say every Marine gets rifleman training. A rifleman, that's a different cat. And you've heard the story of a bunch of them today from India 3-9. And so I get what the Marine Corps is trying to promote, but truck driver ain't a rifleman, right? You see a rifleman in action, you see the shit those guys do, that's a different cat. Right, that's a different cat, and God bless our motor transport guys, but they're not riflemen. Final question.
Well, they get us to the battle. So
we love them, but don't get them confused with the riflemen. A final question. When you look back on how your time in Vietnam changed you as a man. Give me your thoughts about you're in your 70s now. Yes.
Yeah, I'm 74.
You're 74 years old. When you look back on your life, how does Vietnam and your experience as a leader in combat how did that affect your life?
Well, it shaped my life. You don't go through something like that and not have it. Have it affect you. You know, I learned that, you know, if you're going to make a difference in anything, it's up to you to do it. You can't just sit back and wait for somebody else to make all your decisions for you. If you're in battle and you want to live and you're a leader, you better act. But in life, it's the same way. You have a responsibility to your family. You want to sit back on your haunches and just draw benefits from the government, or do you want to pursue a career and be successful and be happy? But you know, it's your choice. You can be a good Marine, you can be a bad Marine. I think inspiration or the training that we provide to our Marines, for me, it obviously started with a drill instructor that he demonstrated to me what it meant to be a good Marine, not just a good Marine, but a good person. Here he was, a drill instructor that was tough as nails, but, had a heart of gold. He did. He had a heart of gold. And if you talk to the men that only had a brief time to know him from Delta 1-4, you'll find out those men love that guy because he took care of them. So, for me, anyway, it's God and country. I love God. I love my family. I love my country. But had it not been for my experience with the Marines that were with me, especially the Marines there at Gatlin's Corner and every other battle I was in, for that matter. You know, they all had a say in how I ended up, and I certainly wouldn't be here today if it were not for them. it takes guts to know that you got a machine gun 30 yards in front of you and you're willing to stand up and expose yourself, digging three Marines out from under, you know, 50, 60 pound stones. But that's what my guys were doing. And, you know, what can you ever say? You think, well, thank you's not enough. To me, I've told many Marines this up at the Semper Fi Odyssey that General Jones runs, that once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
Jack Riley, Sergeant, United States Marine Corps. It's been an absolute privilege. The courage and selflessness of the Marines and sailors on 30 March 1967 at a place now called Getman's Corner or Hill 70 still blows me away when I hear about it. It's stuff like that I can tell you that we are all still mindful of. I was mindful of it when I went to Iraq the first time. That, like, I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I do know this. I'm not going to fail the Marines that depend on me. And it's the legacy that you handed to me, others handed to you, and it's what makes the Marine Corps something pretty unique, and that we are mindful of that. And so I can't thank you enough for coming on and doing this. And I hope you don't mind in the future if we are talking about Haiphong and we are talking about the Vietnam War. I hope you don't mind, Jack, if I give you a call and bring you back on.
I'll be glad to, Mike. Enjoyed it and really enjoyed talking with you.
That is Jack Riley, Sergeant, United States Marine Corps. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.